Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
So welcome back. At this point in our program, we go around the room and introduce ourselves, either our first and or our last names. My name is David Lewis.
Drew.
Ed.
Yes, Joe Good.
Baruch Gold.
Casey.
My name is Tony Pascal.
I'm Bruce.
Roger.
I'm Mark.
My name is Michael.
I'm Alzac.
I am Kay Matsuda.
Kurt.
I'm Jim.
Jack.
Cass.
I'm Jerry Jones.
Peter.
I'm Mark.
Doug.
I'm Carl Goldstein.
I'm Tim.
I'm Kurt.
My name is Clint.
I'm Roy.
Jay.
Jim Stewart.
Clint Paul.
Richard Avellini.
I'm Oswaldo.
Lee Robbins.
My name is Jeff.
My name is Katie.
I'm Conrad.
Thank you. Is anyone here for the first time today? We're returning after. Welcome. Hope you can hang out with us for a while at the refreshment hour. Get to know some of the Sangha. I'm very honored this morning to welcome back Susan Moon, who's spoken to us before. Susan is a writer and teacher, has been for many years, and was the editor of Turning Wheel, the Journal of Socially Engaged Buddhism. She's the author of The Life and Letters of Toku Roshi, a humor book about an imaginary Zen master, and editor of Not Turning Away, The Practice of Engaged Buddhism. Her short stories and essays have been published widely. Her book, This is Getting Old, Zen Thoughts on Aging and Dignity and Humor, came out from Shambhala Press in June 2010, and there's some copies out on the, for sale out on the table in the other room. Susan has been a Zen student since 1976, practicing in the lineage of Suzuki Roshi at Berkeley Zen Center, Tassajara Zen Monastery, Green Gulch Farm, and now at Norman Fisher's Everyday Zen Sangha. She's received entrustment as a lay teacher in 2005. She's the mother of two grown sons and grandmother of Paloma. So welcome, Susan. If there's anything you'd like to add to that, please do.
Thank you very much, David. That was a great, complete introduction. It's great to be back here. I think this is maybe the fifth or sixth time I've been here. And I feel so warmly welcomed here, as I've said before. I really appreciate that you invite me to come, even though I'm not a gay man. But you know, I was thinking that really I am a gay man. So, and you are all straight women. So. Really, there is no separation. That's what we learn in Buddhism. And at the same time, there's a reason why you meet as a Sangha as gay men. Of course, there are a number of reasons, but there are also ways in which we meet without any boundaries at all, and both those things are happening all at the same time. And so I really feel a bit wonderful connection with this Sangha. I love coming back here. Today I wanted to talk about impermanence. And I'm calling this talk, I'm just a link. So, impermanence is one of the three marks of existence, according to Buddhist teachings, along with suffering or unsatisfactoriness, a general unsatisfactoriness of life, not ever quite being quite right, and no fixed self, that our idea of ourself isn't really fixed. We don't really have a self fixed the way we want it. So, but impermanence is the one I wanted to focus on today, that everything is constantly changing, and everything that we love, we lose, and we know that there's a lot of suffering around impermanence. But we also kind of forget the good side to impermanence, so that, you know, flowers fade, but flowers also bloom. If it weren't for impermanence, we wouldn't have birth either. Things appear that were not there before. And also, we're very grateful for impermanence at certain times when we're having a tooth drilled or somebody stepping on our toe or something. It's very nice to know that it's going to change. It's not going to stay like this forever. So impermanence has two sides to it. And then beyond impermanence, we're also looking maybe for what is there beyond impermanence, that can we get to a place that we're not worried about what changes or what we lose or gain. But the big impermanence that we often are thinking about is death, and that we will all die. And I've been thinking about death a lot, and I've been practicing with death awareness recently, in various ways, and I finding it helpful, actually, partly because I'm getting older and I know people who are dying, and I am being reminded constantly that my life is impermanent, that even when we know people who are dying and we lose people close to us, it can be hard to really get it, that this is going to happen to us too. So I have a sign over my desk in my study that I printed out that says, "Don't think for a minute you're not going to die." And I really like having it there, and when I see it, believe it or not, it cheers me up. Oh yeah, yeah, I'm not dead now, I'm alive. So it's a really good wake-up call. Oh, but I'm totally alive in this moment, or I can be. I have that opportunity. And so remembering that we're going to die is also a way of remembering that we are fully alive in this present moment, and a way to bring ourselves forward into the present moment. There's a Buddhist, traditional Buddhist meditations on death, as you may know. There's the Tibetans have a meditation on the charnel ground, where you, the charnel ground being the sky burial, where bodies are left to be eaten by buzzards and their bones dry up in the sun. And so you meditate on these decaying bodies. That's the charnel ground meditation. And you meditate on your own body and imagine it decaying. I haven't taken up that practice particularly, although it might be a good one, but to keep remembering that we are impermanent is really a can't be a very bracing wake-up call, sort of like leaping into a cold stream. I wanted to read you a verse from the teachings of Shantideva, who is a wonderful 7th century Indian Buddhist teacher, who wrote the Bodhisattva's Guide to the Way to a Way of Life, or there's different translations of it, but a guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life, how to be a Bodhisattva, and it's all in verse, and it's, I just love it. But anyway, this is one little section from it, and he says, "Today indeed I'm hale and well. I have enough to eat, and I am not in danger. But this life is fleeting, unreliable. My body is like something briefly lent. Here is now my chance for wholesome deeds." So one of the ways that we can work with impermanence is to give ourselves away to the moment, to each other, to trying to really be helpful and do what we can for others, do wholesome deeds, and feel our connection to others, and then that can bring a lot of joy. I was recently in Ashland, Oregon, at the Shakespeare Festival there, and one morning I was taking a walk, and I walked through an old cemetery that I came upon in the town, and I was looking at the gravestones, and I saw one which I was struck by, and I took a picture of it and copied down what it said, and this is what it said on the gravestone. R.C. Whitney died May 17, 1869, aged 1 year, 1 month, and 1 day. And then there was a little verse which says, by cool Siloam's shady rill, and Siloam, I looked up, and it's a stream near Jerusalem where Jesus apparently healed a blind man. So the verse says, by cool Siloam's shady rill, how sweet the lily grows, how sweet the breath beneath the hill of Sharon's dewy rose. By cool Siloam's shady rill, the lily must decay. The rose that blooms beneath the hill must shortly fade away. So you think of some parents with their one-year-old baby putting this verse on the tombstone. And just this is what a painful kind of impermanence. How hard to accept that. And it reminds me of one of the teaching stories of the Buddha, one of the first Buddhist nuns who came to him. When she came to him, she was her name was Kisa Gotami, and she was a woman in a working class, poor woman in India who had been married, a rich merchant fell in love with her and married her. And his family didn't like her because she was poor, from the wrong caste, but then she had a son, and she got some status because of having a son, and she loved her son. And then her son, as a toddler, died, and she went mad with grief, and she'd lost everything, and she was kicked out of the family, and she took the dead baby in her arms, and she went from house to house. She couldn't believe, she was too crazed to really understand that the child had died. And she kept knocking on one door after another, asking people, please give me medicine to help my baby. Please give me medicine. And everybody just said, sorry, there's nothing we can do. And finally, somebody who saw her, how crazy she was, took pity on her and said, well, there's somebody over there who can help you. Go talk to the man over there in the Jetta Grove. So she went over to where Buddha was teaching, and she said, please help me, give me medicine for my baby. And he said, I can help you if you bring me a mustard seed from a household that has never known death. And so she went full of hope and started knocking on doors some more and asking for a mustard seed. At first he would say, have you known death? And then she was going to get the mustard seed. But of course she didn't find one. And she went back to the Buddha and said, well, I get it. Everybody has known death. This happens to everybody, sooner or later. And it was a kind of enlightenment experience for her, and then she became one of Buddha's nuns. But in the meantime, she was able to see that her baby had died, and they buried the baby and gave it a ceremony. So anyway, I thought of her baby when I saw this gravestone, and of course all the other babies that died. But it is part of what the teaching is, that this happens to everyone. No one is freed from this. It doesn't say, you know, everybody's going to die except me. But there's some part of our mind that still thinks that. And there's some relief, actually, as there was for Kisa Gotami. There's some relief in realizing I'm not different from anyone else. Why shouldn't this happen to me? There's why me, but also why not me? Of course me. So practicing with an awareness of death is a way to feel one's connection to everybody else. And to sort of let go of the idea of your own specialness. And if you let go of the idea of your own specialness, it makes you more able to be generous with yourself. And there's another practice that I've been doing lately, and that's a kind of death meditation, where I, from time to time, I read the obituaries in the paper, not the big ones of the famous people, which you read anyway because you're interested in their lives, but the little paid ads that people put in that are just ordinary small lives going on, or sometimes big lives, but all different lives. And it's just an amazing feeling to read through it and just realize the multiplicity of lives that are being led on this planet, and all the different ways that people express themselves in their lives, and then all the different people who are grieving them when they die. And so, and I thought sometimes it would be an interesting practice to get a group of people together and just read aloud, as if you're doing a Buddhist chant, read aloud these little obituaries together. But anyway, I wanted to read you a few excerpts from one day's paper. This actually is the New York Times. But these are just some little snippets from some of them that will give you a feeling for the kind of the feeling that I'm getting from it, too. So here's Bradford Black, 24. In the last year, he had rediscovered his lifelong passion for food and was pursuing a diploma in culinary arts. He was so proud of his creations, frequently emailing photos of his dishes to his family and friends. Here's former New York State Supreme Court Justice Andrew DePaolo, 86. All kinds of things. I'm just going to read you one part. Until his retirement at the age of... Oh, he took great joy in the company of his grandchildren, teaching them dominoes, and they will remember their... They will remember their Poppy, for his tiny print here. They will remember their Poppy for his unfailing support and unique sense of humor. Or Barrett Gahagan, 82, director of sales at WABC-TV. He was a jazz enthusiast who enjoyed deep sea fishing in the Florida waters, but his passion was always television. Here's Ida Goldstein. She is survived by her devoted partner, Patricia Petricelli. She is recognized as the authority on the application of psychoanalytic theory to clinical social work. And Richard Lonoff, 90, he did yeoman service as principal of PS 20 in the South Bronx. You know, great heroism in these lives. Cameron Nichols, recent graduate of high school, 18 years old, full of life. Our hearts are broken. May he rest in peace. Lucy Porges, we are so proud of her remarkable life. Born in Vienna, Austria, 1926, forced by war to leave her homeland. Met her future husband in Geneva in 1945. They created a new life in New York, where she designed beautiful clothes. One more. Martin Saltzman, 73, an ethical man. He was described by his partners at Holtz Rubinstein Remnick as the accountant's accountant. So isn't this great? All these different people doing all these different things, teaching their grandchildren dominoes and running the public schools and who knows what all. And they all die. And all of us and our wonderful things we do, we're going to go too. So, being present now really does help us to give ourselves away to each other. To be fully present means we can be fully responsive in the moment that we're living in. And it doesn't just mean, you know, kind of enjoying our bliss state and sort of zoning out. It means really not turning away from what's in front of us and being available to the people who are around us and to people at a greater distance if we choose. Not long ago I saw the movie Of Gods and Men. Have some of you seen that movie? It's very moving. And it's about a historical incident that took place in 1996. A group of French Cistercian monks formed a monastery in Algeria. There were about nine of them, I think, eight or nine of them, and they lived in the village there and served the needs of the people in the village. They weren't there to convert people. They were very respectful of the Islamic culture there. But they had a garden and they had a clinic and they were there really to serve people locally, and they were very devoted. And then terrorists began making raids in the area and doing brutal killings, and some people in the village were killed, and these Cistercian monks were very threatened, and some terrorists came one day to the monastery and asked for some medicine, and somehow they went away again, but then it was clear that they might easily come back, and the monks were trying to decide whether to leave, and various people were urging them, go back to France, you'll be safe, go back to France, and together they decided their life was there, that was their life, there was no reason for why would they go back to France? To be safe, yes, for what? So they agreed very courageously to just stay no matter what and to continue their service as best they could. And then as they were making the decision, they had these consensus meetings to try and come to an understanding together. And one of the monks, who was very sick actually himself, but he was also the one who ran the clinic, the medical clinic, said at one point in the movie, I'm not afraid of the terrorists. I'm not afraid to die. I'm a free man. And he sort of says that with great exuberance in the meeting. And that was, for me, a very inspiring line, that his lack of fear, his lack of, you know, that he knew that he was going to die and he wasn't afraid to die, gave him total freedom. So that's maybe the kind of freedom that we're aiming for. It's maybe a stretch, maybe a little ways away, for me certainly, but I can really understand that. Not clinging to one's life gives one a kind of freedom. So then I wanted to go on to the second part of my talk about we're just a blink to we're just a link, and to how small we are in the vastness of things, but we're part of something very vast, and we are a part of it. And maybe some of you have had the experience that I, probably all of you have had an experience like this that I've had, where, for example, I've been up backpacking in the mountains, which I can't really do anymore, but I remember sitting down for a break by a mountain stream and on a nice sun-warmed piece of granite, and I'm getting a drink of water, and there's a bright blue lupin and bright red Indian paintbrush, and the day is just so incredibly precious, and I just feel completely at peace, and the mountains are so huge, and I see them and I think, oh my gosh, these mountains have been here for so long and my life is so tiny by comparison, and I'm just a little blink in this vastness, and I could die right now. It would be okay if I died right now. I've said that to myself sometimes in those moments, just feeling so at peace in a way. And also, it's just such a good feeling to realize that you're small in a way, because it kind of diminishes, like if you get grease spots on your favorite blouse, it doesn't seem so important in a moment like that. So it's good to remember this. And another movie I saw recently was Cave of Forgotten Dreams, Werner Herzog's movie about the cave paintings in France. And some of you have probably seen that too, which is just incredible and amazing. And I recommend it if you haven't seen it. It's in 3D, and so these stalactites kind of come right out at you, and you can practically reach them and pluck them off the walls of the cave. But anyway, the cave paintings there are 35,000 years old, and they are twice as old as any other cave paintings that have been discovered. And these horses are running along the walls, just whinnying and running and looking so alive, and the people who painted them there are just right with you when you're looking at them. You just think, wow, this is so alive, and yet it was 35,000 years ago. And there's some sense of being, you know, in a chain of human life and that comes through somehow, that they're long ago, but they're right with us right this minute as well. This life is with us, that they lived, is here in us now. There's a quotation from Dogen, who writes about time. He was a Zen master in Japan in the 1200s. And he said, "Each moment is all being, is the entire world. Reflect now whether any world is left out of this moment." So there's time is in layers, and we're all the layers are here at once in a way. And when we look, for example, at the stars, we look at the Andromeda galaxy out there in space, what we're seeing is something that happened the Andromeda galaxy was 300,000 years ago. That's what we're seeing right now. But we're seeing it now, but it happened 300,000 years ago. And if there are other beings in space looking at planet Earth through their telescopes, then we don't know how far away they might be, but if they are looking at us, they won't see the nuclear plant at Fukushima Daiichi blowing up for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. They won't even know about it. So there's this huge stretch of time that we're in the middle of. And in this present moment, we're here on a kind of pivot point in time. And we're alive in this very moment. And so we're kind of gate between what's come before and what's coming later. And time is kind of funneling its way through us in a sense. Sometimes I think of it that way, as if we're sort of a ring and it's just whooshing through, but we're always in the present moment. There's a way that we, in Buddhism, there's a lot, especially in Zen, there's a tremendous amount of respect for the ancestors, and we chant the names of the ancestors, and when you get one of these things, you get a little lineage chart that tells all the names of the ancestors from Buddha down to my teacher, to me. There's like 35 names on this list, and supposedly all the generations that have passed the teaching on. And it's kind of like getting your American Kennel Club pedigree. But it's kind of a fiction, because some of the people on some of the links lived hundreds of years apart and couldn't have actually passed the teachings on one to the next. But the idea is kind of a nice one, even so, that there are these ancestors that have been passing along knowledge, and not just in Buddhism, but in all the realms of our human existence. You know, the generations change, and we're just in a generation. And so much has come to us. The language we speak has come to us from our ancestors, and then we pass on what we pass on. And this brings us into a sense of deep time and the sense of our responsibility to what is in the future, to responsibility to the ancestors in honoring them and learning from their teachings, and then responsibility to pass on and take care of as best we can the generations to come. And you probably, as we know that the Native American cultures that talk about seven generations and taking care of seven generations ahead into the future. And here is a quote from the Constitution of the Iroquois Nation, which had a very well-developed constitution. And they say, in all of your deliberations, in your efforts at lawmaking, in all your official acts, self-interest shall be cast into oblivion. Look and listen for the welfare of the whole people, and have always in view not only the present, but also the coming generations, even those whose faces are yet beneath the surface of the ground, the unborn of the future nation. So, and that includes that idea of letting go of self-clinging there, that self-interest shall be cast into oblivion. I love it that they say that. And then you may also know of the teachings of Joanna Macy. I think maybe she's been here to talk to you. And she's a wonderful Buddhist teacher, eco-philosopher, environmentalist, systems theory person. And she teaches about deep time, and she has an invocation to the beings of the past, present, and future, which she uses in her teaching. And I wanted to read you a little bit from that. I'll just read a shortened version of it. We call first on the beings of the past. Be with us now, all you who have gone before, you, our ancestors and teachers, you who walked and loved and faithfully tended this earth. Be present to us now, that we may carry on the legacy you bequeathed us. Aloud and silently in our hearts, we say the names and see your faces. We call also on the beings of the present, all you with whom we live and work on this endangered planet, all you with whom we share this brink of time, be with us now. Fellow humans and brothers and sisters of other species, help us open to our collective will and wisdom. Aloud and silently, we say your names and picture your faces. Lastly, we call on the beings of the future, all you who will come after us on this earth, be with us now. All you who are waiting to be born in the ages to come, it is for your sakes, too, that we work to heal our world. We cannot picture your faces or say your names. You have none yet. But we would feel the reality of your claim on, but we feel the reality of your claim on life. It helps us to be faithful in the task that must be done, so that there will be for you, as there was for our ancestors, blue sky, fruitful land, clear waters. And I think recently of something that's a scientific concept called the precautionary principle, which is spoken of in international relations now. And it's simply the idea that if an action or a policy has a suspected risk of causing harm to the public or the environment, then the burden of proof is on the people doing something to find out ahead of time whether it's going to be okay. Like, don't drill 5 miles under the ocean floor for oil unless you really know it's going to be okay and there's not going to be this huge leak. So we're not really following the precautionary principle very well in our doings. But in some legal systems now, it's actually becoming law. And in the law of the European Union, they've adopted the precautionary principle. So we can, I don't know how well it's enforced, but there is a tendency, as we've seen historically, that, oh, well, this will probably work out all right, and this drug will probably help. But we need to really be on the side, err on the side of caution. We keep learning that. So we who are here right now in this room, in this, on this planet right at this moment, we really are a link, and we're sort of like the whole time is spreading out on either side of us, and we have a job to pass it on in whatever way we want to. It might be, you know, it could be something very simple that you don't even think of as doing that. It doesn't mean that you have to be a scholar teaching the ancient teachings and writing them down for future generations or something. It could just be that you're making a garden in a place where you learned how to use the soil and you're preparing it for what's going to happen, what's coming. So much of what we do is doing that in some way or other. But to really think of ourselves as this, being on this sort of pivot point, or sort of the middle of the mirror, like we're reflecting both directions. I like that. And I've been working on a book that kind of connects to this with another writer, Zen friend of mine, who Florence Kaplow, she and I are doing a book on women's koans from the past. We're collecting 100, it's going to be 100 women's koans from traditional sources, going all the way back to Buddha and coming up to contemporary times, that are dialogues demonstrating women's wisdom. And since you're all women, I know you'll be interested in it. And it's I've just come to realize how grateful I am for the fact that working with these koans, that the teachings of the past still are meaningful to me, just like those paintings on the cave walls, you know, that we can connect to them.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.